This is Teddy Teapot with Teddy Mellencamp.
Hi, you guys. Welcome back to Teddy Teapot. I am super excited about this week. One, we have on Leslie Ann Bruce, who is a number one New York Times bestselling co-author of the book, You Are a F***ing Awesome Mom. Which, how great is that? I've got Leslie with me right now.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
And we are going to be talking all things children's anxiety. So I struggle with anxiety myself. And then also, my son has a form of anxiety that's really just kind of cropped up in the past year, where he all of a sudden decided he could no longer sleep in his own room. He didn't want to go in public bathrooms. Like, all of these things started kind of changing in our life. And for about 4.5 months, he was my husband and my roommate. Like, we set up a full bed in our room, like, for him. He camped out with us. And it wasn't really until his teacher said to us, Teddy, Edwin, before the baby comes, you need to move him out, because you don't want to do it once the baby comes and then him feel like, oh, you're getting the boot because you have a little sister that just arrived. And then he'll have all these feelings towards her. So we started doing our research on figuring out the best methods. And the biggest thing that has worked for us has been meditation.
With him.
And I am like a terrible meditator myself. Mm-hmm. Like, but he craves it, loves it, is obsessed with it, like sits there and is like, every single night before we go to bed, he's like, Mom, can we get Andy? That's the guy's name that speaks on Headspace. And he's become like our best friend. I think we're at like 997 minutes meditated.
Oh, wow.
In the last couple of months. So really, that's worked for us. And as we've been doing Andy / Headspace, everything else has kind of shifted. He started being able to go back into public restrooms. He's not as frightened of certain things. And I've started to learn that if I manage his expectations in advance, we have less like chaos when it comes right down to it.
Right. Did you notice, is it like a separation anxiety with you? Or is it like, what is it? What kind of anxiety do you think it is?
We don't really know, because it really has been changing so often. And, you know, at first I'm like, is it even anxiety? Is it when I'm working a lot? Is it when, but it didn't shift in regards to, like, it wasn't like when I was filming the show or not, right. You know, it was kind of just, but I had gotten pregnant.
Right.
So that's, I think that thing may have had a way bigger effect than I could have imagined.
Right. So I definitely saw that with I have two kids. My daughter is 5 and my son is now 20 months. And I definitely saw that. And it's just change in general, I think, with my daughter. And she has, I mean, my husband and I both have anxiety. I had horrible postpartum anxiety after my son was born. But during my pregnancy, it was a high risk pregnancy. I was on bed rest a bunch. And so it sort of manifests in the house. Right. And I feel like there's like this, like, spillover effect. And so I saw with my daughter, anytime that there's like major change, anytime that we're shifting her dynamic, it can feel tense for her. And when I got pregnant, we had that. And when we moved, we had that new school, all of that. And it's just, and the key for our family, I think, is just the communication, really setting expectations. This is what's going to happen. She works well under kind of a controlled chaos.
Right. That's funny that you said that, because the same exact kind of thing happened with me. I was with my other kids. I was on a, you know, partial bed rest on and off. I started getting terrible postpartum anxiety as well. So as I'm hearing you say that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm having complete flashbacks. But then, you know, I have my son who has, you know, for the last 8 months kind of struggled with it. And then recently my daughter, our dog passed away.
Oh.
And she had a totally different form of, I didn't think it was anxiety at all. I thought maybe she was sick until I took her to the doctor, where she kept saying, Mom, I can't catch my breath. And it happened, and it was all through the holidays, and she kept saying, I can't catch my breath. And so I took her to the doctor, And we'd been, you know, I thought maybe it's acid reflux. I was like doing research on what to give kids for acid reflux, et cetera, et cetera. And we went into the doctor and I'm like, these are her symptoms. And she like puts her on a breathing machine, has a conversation with her. And then she looked at Slate and she goes, Slate, has anything been bothering you recently? And she goes, yeah, my dog died. And I've just been really sad.
Oh.
And I was like immediately trying to like reel it in because I wanted to like break down at that moment. And the doctor goes, you know, you're not sick, right? You're okay. That whatever you're feeling right now, it's just emotional. And she didn't say just, I said just, but she's like, it's emotional. Right. You know, maybe do some breathing or you can do some yoga with your mom or some meditation or different things like that. But you are not sick. You are fine.
Right.
And I'm not kidding. The next day, she was fine. So it's such a different thing. Like, she just needed someone to tell her, you're okay.
Right.
Whereas my son, it's like, we do this every night. We do Headspace. We're constantly, you know, discussing things that, you know, walking into the dark room or walking into, you know, different spaces. But it's crazy how different our kids are and how they handle things completely different, even though we're all in the same house.
Right. I feel like that goes across the board with parenting. Like how I raise one child is going to be completely different from how I have to raise the other. And, you know, same general guidelines and morals and all of that. But my daughter responds so differently to things than my son does. And to have to, I mean, for me, having to like figure out parenting in general and then having to figure out parenting two different kids in two different ways, it often, it can feel like a lot, but you realize that they just respond so differently and so well to different things.
Yeah.
So you've got to like, you got to be flexible.
You got to be flexible. I know. Even the doctor was like, maybe you should start meditating with Slate as well. And we did it that first night when we came home from the doctor. And I go, you want to do Andy, you know, with Cruz and I? And she goes, okay. And then night two, she goes, Mom, I don't need to meditate anymore. I'm fine. I'm not having the breathing issue anymore. Like she wants nothing to do with it. And she hasn't brought up the breathing thing again. Whereas Cruz is like, Mom, can we do 3 Andys tonight, 4 Andys tomorrow, back to 3 the next day? Like, he is so regimented.
I love that. Do you think with your daughter that did it have anything to do with, like, I feel like with my daughter, I'm having to explain death to her. And that's a really, I'm trying to figure out how to do it in a way that's, like, appropriate for her age.
I think she was, because she didn't, properly, it wasn't like the dog was sick, like a tragic thing happened to the dog. We had dropped it off at a doggy daycare place and the woman had an accident with the dog and the dog passed away. And like we were out of town and we came back and the dog was gone. Like there was no goodbye. There was nothing. And the first week we were all emotional about it. Like we were on and on, like leaky faucets, like crying one day, laughing, you know, like grieving. But then she didn't talk about it anymore. So then I was like, oh, maybe this is past for her. But then it creeped back in. And I think she didn't know how to express it. And I should have asked, you know, and
right.
In hindsight, I should have been like, how are you feeling? But I was like, oh, well, she's not talking about it. Maybe we don't need to talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
Because then I don't break down and I, you know, but it was probably avoidance on all of our part. And, you know, she was internalizing it somehow.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So before we take a break, I want to introduce our next guest who's actually going to help us dig into all of these anxiety and stress questions when it comes to kids. Her name is Susan Zinn. She is a psychotherapist. She works in California and New York. She has a private practice and she specializes in working with teenagers, young adults, and families. So I am so excited. I can't even tell you how many listener questions. This topic was above any other with questions. Like my inbox was flooded. So let's get to it right after we take a break. So here we are. We are back with Susan and Leslie, and we are talking all things anxiety. So, I mean, selfishly, I want to ask about my own kids first, my parenting. So I want to dig kind of right into this. So something that's kind of gone on with my son, which I gave a little backstory before you came in, but he was having trouble going into his own room. So for a while, my husband and I kind of just let him sleep with us in our room. We called him our roommate. And then we've recently transitioned him to his own room because we didn't want to do it right when the baby came. So we are about a month into it, but it truthfully has to be one of us at night doing meditation for at least 20 minutes while he falls asleep. We have a reward chart for him in the morning every night, you know, after he, you know, wakes up, then we praise him, we give him that. But I mean, it is a constant battle because he's extremely scared about his dreams. So I was wondering if you had any other advice for us and things that we could do. We also talk, you know, we have faith. So we talk about like, you know, you're protected, everything's good. But he's like, I prayed, it's not helping.
I think it's so important to normalize their behavior and what's happening in their nervous system. I mean, kids also love science. So to really kind of have them understand, oh, this is normal for you to feel like going into your room without mom and dad may be something scary when he's five, right? Is really important. And so I think you're doing a great job of really working with a reward system and kind of getting him to a routine and a habit of, you know, how to go to sleep and actually feel safe. But, you know, keep talking, just like as you talked about with your daughter, as normalizing this behavior. And so he can kind of keep gaining that skill of really kind of feeling that he's capable of going to sleep and capable of actually mastering this skill on his own, which is going to give him a great sense of agency.
Right, that confidence that he can do it.
Yes.
I mean, in that same token, a girlfriend of mine, her daughter has recently just started bedwetting again. Could that be a form of anxiety?
Yes, for sure. And the thing is that we, with children, we don't really, they don't have the maturity to really understand oftentimes what their emotional states are and to be able to articulate them. So they come out in behaviors and actions. And so it's really up to us as parents in order to help them to correlate the language with what's actually going on, being curious about it, being curious about certain actions that are happening during their day that may be resulting in an action, and also not shaming. We take back steps as children. We take forward steps. It doesn't always have to be kind of on this sort of linear trajectory of doing everything perfectly. So I think it's really just about being calm and being able to connect with our children. And being able to help them with language to understand what's happening.
Well, how do you, as a parent, how are you able to figure out if it's something is a behavior or if they are developing or suffering from an anxiety? Mm-hmm. How can you figure it out in order to help them?
Yeah, I mean, the first step is always going to your pediatrician and making sure that there isn't any medical issue that's coming up. But the other issue that I'm super passionate about is I think that we're limiting our language for this generation and for our children of their feeling states. They're allowed to be happy. They're allowed to be sad. They're allowed to be anxious and they're allowed to be depressed. And that's kind of how we talk about language with kids with feelings. We label so many things as anxiety when they actually might be excitement, right? Because in our feeling state, anxiety, love, and excitement feel exactly the same. We get the heart palpitation. We might even get sweaty. We might get excited. But we limit that. And I think it's really about expanding out feeling states for our children to really give them a range and be able to kind of connect with different things that are happening. They may be frustrated. They may be annoyed. They may be super excited. But they have a hard time kind of connecting those things. And that's really what our job is.
Should we be avoiding using the word anxiety in front of our kids?
I actually think so. I think that we overuse it in our society. And they do, too. I mean, we love to label things in order to understand them in our brains, right? But I think that being expansive on kind of what different feelings are so important. There's actually a great book called The Human Emotion Book. And I think it goes through just the various types of emotional states. And there's some really crazy ones that you haven't even ever thought of. And I think kind of exploring that with our children of, can we really expand these out is super important.
Because a popular thing that is coming up for pretty much everyone I know is how do you help learning / identifying? I mean, other than going to your pediatrician, but like if as somebody who struggles with anxiety, I am hyper-focused when I think it might be anxiety. So how do you identify it with your child without creating a bigger issue?
Right. I think that what you're talking about is so important because you have to really look at what is yours and what's theirs.
Right.
Right. So first unpacking that, the fact is, oh, am I feeling anxious about this? Am I feeling anxious that they're not transitioning? Am I feeling anxious that Cruz is not in his bed and we're having a baby in a month? Or is this really about him? Right. Or is he ready for it too? That's right. Also a big part of it. You know, he's not going to go to college sleeping in your bed.
So. I mean, you know, those morning hugs are pretty great.
It's funny that you say that because actually my my sister went through a divorce and her 11-year-old still is now with my brother out of the house. He's developed an attachment to her where he has to be in bed with her. And now he's 11 and she has the guilt of not letting of the change that's happened. And so she's allowing him to kind of be in the room. And but she doesn't know when it's what's a healthy amount of sort of
time
and cuddling and all of that. And then when does it get to the point of, OK, now it's time to transition into our next chapter? Like, how do you navigate? Because it feels like it's such like a it's a tightrope.
You don't want to say no. You don't want to say yes. Yeah. You know, you want to do the right thing.
I think that's the hard part about parenting, right? It's all individual and we all love to judge one another, too. So it's really when it's starting to interfere either with their functioning or yours.
Right.
So the fact is, if it's interfering with your life or your sleep or whatever it may be, then that's the time to actually really work on transitions. If it's not and it's working for the family, then it's embracing it.
And also when it comes to kids, oftentimes you'll see a child say, oh, I hurt my arm or my foot or my toe or my whatever. I can't go to PE or I don't want to go to dance class today because my leotard hurts my, you know, arm, you know, whatever it may be. Is that a form of anxiety or is it attention or what is that?
Right. Again, I think this goes back to the question of overusing that word anxiety, but it's also really about being attuned and being curious about what's going on with a child and unpacking that. Because it may be a fear base. And the fact is our nervous system does what our nervous system should do with anxiety, which is keep us alive and keep us safe. And so oftentimes it misfires, right? And so the fact is that going to the dance class may feel terrifying to a child, which is, causes them anxiety. Or it may be something else that actually is really going on. But I think for us to really kind of move into our child and explore, so why do you get a stomach ache every single time you're going to dance class? What's going on with that? Is there something that I can help navigate with you and really bring down to their level, their understanding of what's going on with them internally?
But a lot of times your kids will say, nothing, no. No. If you get to that, then what's your next question? What's your next plan?
Right. Yeah, because they oftentimes don't know. And so it's really up to us to kind of be able to investigate, to be curious, to be talking to the teachers, maybe to other parents, to observe and see what's going on that may be causing our child conflict and then moving into asking them about those specific issues.
Is there a certain time of day or a certain situation where you think is the best time to talk to your kids about those kind of things?
In the car.
In the car?
I think oftentimes when there's too much focus, that's really when it gets into those feelings of moving back and maybe I'm embarrassed about this or maybe I'm feeling shameful. So when they're coming home from school and you're driving them home from school or maybe they're having a snack or maybe it's before bedtime, whatever it may be when they're actually really calm is to moving into having them to have that conversation about dropping down and what's going on with them in during their day.
Just the communication. I had heard this in, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I had heard this statistic or this study that said that as a parent, if you can connect 25 minutes uninterrupted every day with your kid, no phone, no outside anything, and just be in front of your child, that there's not a lot that can get past you. That, you know, whether it's depression or bullying or whatever it is that's going on in their life, if you're connecting with them for 25 minutes a day, that you'll be able to catch anything that's going on. And that felt like a really attainable number to me.
Yeah. I'm like, I could do that.
Yeah,
I do that.
I think it's really about also teaching them how to be present, right? So because with all the social media and being overscheduled and the amount of commitments that we all have now, you know, we're teaching our children how to be competitive at very young ages. There's a lot of pressure on them to achieve both in school, sports, whatever it may be. Really giving them that gift of presence is so important. So if you have that 25 minutes to really connect with them, really be curious about what's going on with them, really ask them the questions, to know them, you're doing a great job as a parent.
What verbiage would you give our listeners to somebody whose their child has a big game or a big test? Because a lot of the times you hear about a child will go in and become paralyzed to even take a test because they're so nervous about not doing well in it. Or they, you know, don't even try and practice because they're so frightened that they might have to go into the game. So, like, what is the verbiage we should put around it so that we take the pressure off, but we're also, you know, we're there for them?
Right. I always go back to science when we're talking to our kids, right? Because they understand it from a very young age, but their brain is doing what a brain does. But the problem is it misfires all the time. So it doesn't know the difference between a test and something really exciting. So I think normalizing that behavior and going, look, this could feel really scary for you to be going into, but you've got it. You've trained. You've done the work. You're ready for this. And now it's just about breathing and calming down your nervous system in order for you to be able to do the best that you can.
How do we communicate that to like younger children, like to like the 4 or 5, 6 year old, where maybe the talking of the science might be a little bit over their head? How do we help them to sort of get their, you know, wrap around their emotions?
I actually disagree with that. I think they get it at a very young age. I think you can name it. Sometimes it's even really great to call their amygdala misfiring as something Amy or Joe or whatever it may be, in order to give them a language around that, for them to feel more agency and control. So the earlier that you're actually really teaching them that, that they can feel safe in their bodies, and this is just their brain misfiring, we get out of that, you know, talking about anxiety and talking about fear base and talking about lack of safety. And we get really into feeling more in control.
And I mean, maybe I did this wrong, but Cruz has been having a little bit of a tough time with his letters. And so I said to him, hey, bud, if every day this week we work on the letters in the morning, we'll do a little check mark and then you can get a gift at the end of the week because you know, you're committing to do the time. I'm not kidding. Within 2 minutes, he was like, A, B, C, little C, big D. So, like, I'm not kidding. For months, I've been worried about this. Like, he's not getting the letters. They brought it up to me, blah, blah, blah. But the second I did the reward, but then am I also pressuring him? See, it's conflicting. So then I, as a mom, I'm like, well, am I always going to have to bribe him to show me what he knows? Like, what is happening?
I mean, we talk about motivation all the time, right? And so he was super motivated to learn his letters to get that reward.
But it was like 3 minutes. I was like, you've got to. I mean, but then I'm curious, is he fibbing to his sisters and I? Because I'm not kidding, 20 minutes before, we were all kind of playing around on his board and he could not do it. And he was like kind of playing around. And then he was like, I don't know. Is that a J? Is it a J? You know, like all that type of stuff. But then the second a reward came in, he knew all of it. But then how do you get it when it actually counts? Because he's doing that at school as well. For him, I mean, I can't go walking around with like the Amazon pulled up on my phone. Like, hey, here you go, buddy.
He's hustling you.
Yeah, he's hustling me.
Well, it's also teaching our kids about internal and external reward, right? So the goal is, as a parent right now, you're giving him an external reward to hopefully kind of start building the internal. And that's what makes a self-reliant and child later on. It's what our really goal as a parent is. But I think that each kid is different, and trying to find that motivation, whether they're feeling sort of that sense of confidence that they can master something, which is amazing, or they're needing some kind of push from a parent in order to kind of get them there. But you can't kind of measure every situation as being the same either. So as a mom, you've got to give yourself a little bit of a break and not think that every single situation that he's going to learn is going to actually need the same exact formula.
I'm really bad at that. I'm really hard on myself when it comes to the kids because I don't know. I guess I have this fear of like making a mistake. that will do damage. You know, even though I know you trust your instincts and you know all of those things, but it's, I think also because I'm pregnant that like I just want kind of them to feel happy. And so when those types of little things happen, then I'm like, what am I doing wrong? What I take it personally.
Right. I think you mentioned something really important there is you just want them to be happy. Well, we're never one constant emotional state. They're going to feel different ranges of emotion, and you have to be okay being uncomfortable as a mom that they're not always going to be happy. And that's actually really teaching your kids important things too, that they don't have to chase these constant states, which causes anxiety.
Well, speaking of that, what is the answer to temper tantrums? If your child is prone to having major temper tantrums, like what, in your opinion, is the best way to handle it?
Each child is really different. And I think sometimes not focusing on it is the best way to go. Because when we hyper focus on anything, it can either give them a reward, right? Because they're getting the attention that they want, or they're feeling a tremendous amount of shame about not being able to have the control over their emotional states. And children really need to learn that. They need to learn how to control how they're feeling. They need to learn how to have the coping skills in order to sort of manage their emotional states. So it's really kind of coming up with them together about figuring out how to get in front of it. Because when they are having a tantrum, it is actually, they've flown the coop. There's nothing that's coming back. You just have to let them kind of work it out in order for them to come back. Because there's no prefrontal cortex actually working for them to give them any sort of ability to think through logical ways of coping with what they're feeling at this point. They're just reacting in a really, really big way. So really strategizing up front, coming up with routines, coming up with a structure ahead of time in order to manage the things that you realize that do tend to cause the tantrums is super important.
What about for a child who becomes violent with their parents?
That is really kind of bringing in professional help when they do become violent.
From the very first time?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they are so out of control with their emotional state that they can't actually calm themselves down. And you're really going to need a third party in there to help you as a parent with the coping skills and the tools in order to manage. And there may be other factors that are going on for them to be feeling that they have to be that violent in order to sort of express their feelings or to be able to manage what's happening. And I would 100% recommend getting either counseling from school or professional help in order to help you, because it's just too difficult as a parent. There's too much pressure for you, and you don't want to be in conflict with your child in that way.
Can we define violence? Because when I took my daughter to Disney on Ice before the holidays, and I got her a quesadilla instead of a hamburger, and the frustration was like so real that she bit my hand because she didn't know how to communicate. She's like, Mom, I asked for a hamburger. You got me a quesadilla. I'm like, whatever. And she bit my hand. Is that violence that we go to?
I think as a parent, you've got to be able to judge, right? So if it was something that she has remorse straight afterwards and you work it out. And so much of conflict that you have between your child is really about teaching them communication and repair. So for you to say to her, you can't do that. You can't actually bite me when you're that frustrated. You got to be able to talk about your feelings. We got to figure out how to cope with things and manage things together is a better way. But if you're finding that she's repeatedly biting you every time she gets frustrated or angry, that's really when you need professional help to step in.
Right.
And what age is your daughter again?
She's five.
Five. Because you'll sometimes see, I'll be at the park and you'll see a kid like kick their parents or, you know, but they're frustrated. But if it becomes a pattern,
exactly.
That's where you know that.
Yeah. Or the parents are not managing it well, too. So
they might be being violent back.
Exactly. Or being emotionally or verbally abusive. That's the other factor that fuels it. And then we're just bringing in that cycle of shame.
Could you give our listeners some sort of idea, like things they could be saying that are verbally abusive that they don't realize?
There's so many different ways that we do that. I think that really it's about comparing our children to other people and saying, well, you know, Johnny does that a lot better than you do, and really kind of shaming our child into something. I think that we can talk about their behavior as being something really negative or bad or evil. We can talk about them being insufficient or lacking in some capacity. Anything that's going to really knock a child's self-esteem or confidence, that's going to sort of prey on their insecurities as they're sort of developing who they are as human beings, I feel is emotionally abusive and really tough.
On that note, we have to take a little break, but we'll come back and grill you a little more. Okay, now we're back, and since we've asked all of our questions, I think, I mean, not all of ours, but all we have time for of our questions, I want to kind of rapid fire do some of our listeners' questions. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, why do kids bite their nails?
Kids bite their nails for various reasons. It can be from boredom to really managing stress because it is a self-soothing mechanism. And so 50% of children bite their nails. And a lot of parents just ignore it. But if it becomes problematic or you're finding that the behavior is becoming too problematic, some kids actually bite them down to theirs actually sort of to their cuticles and it actually becomes painful, then you really need to kind of start to come up with different tactics, whether it's putting nail polish or varnish on or manicure in order for them to sort of create different ways to manage their stress than actually through nail biting.
One listener had written in that their 6-year-old granddaughter saw an image of a man who was shot on TV and has had anxiety ever since. How do we help our children if there's, you know, when they're hearing the news or the things on the outside?
Right. The hard thing with media now is that they have so much exposure to it. And our brains don't know the difference between reality and fiction. So when a child is actually going to see a horrific image, it actually feels as if it's something that's happening to them now. And so it's really kind of normalizing that behavior with that child and sort of have them understand that this is, the world is unsafe. And unfortunately, this is something that they saw way too early and too soon. But just to reinforce their feeling of safety in the world is going to be so important for that child in order for them to start feeling calm again. And I really am a big believer in understanding what's appropriate media for our children at what age. And if a child's experiencing any sort of anxiety or trauma, it's a no-no for any type of violence, anything that's going to kind of cause their bodies to sort of to misfire in that way. So I like to say lots of rainbows and ponies that they get to watch.
In that same token, loud noises really upset my toddler. What are some ways I can keep him calm?
Right. There's several ways to really think about it. And one of the things we have to really think about is what type of personality does a child have? And sometimes that kids could be on the spectrum or they could be more of an introverted child that loud noises and lots of people tends to upset them more. So again, it's being curious about who your child is, but to figure out how much they can tolerate, coming up with a plan ahead of time. I know you love routines and schedules, but this would be really about if you're going to a family function, how much can they actually manage? Putting them in situations that they may be able to tolerate for shorter periods of time than to kind of keep them there and keep them hyper aroused or overwhelmed the whole time is really important.
While you said spectrum, what is something a parent should do? Or like, what are signs that maybe your child is on the spectrum and what are the steps they should take?
Right. Again, I think this is a term that we're overusing in our culture at this point about talking about people being on the spectrum because we're all different and we all have kind of a range. It's really important to be working with a professional at that point. If you're sort of suspecting anything out of the norm is going on with your child with spectrum issues, rather than misdiagnosing or getting into kind of a language around it.
Right. But you said a loud noise would possibly be a child being on the spectrum. So for a parent hearing that, if all of a sudden I heard this, then I would go, oh, well, my daughter is afraid of loud noises. So I'm just trying to give them some sort of
range
of mm-hmm. other things to yeah. keep an eye on before you rush to the doctor, because, you know, that can also be they have sensitive ears or, you know, there's so many different
yeah.
things.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's really kind of sensory issues, difficulty time with connecting with other peers or within the school, ability with eye contact, feeling withdrawn, not engaging, not seeming to be paying attention. There's a big range of it, but it's really kind of seeing that they're not able to kind of connect in the way that maybe other children are. And also too, that high social anxiety, being around certain individuals or situations causing them a tremendous amount of stress, those would be signs that we would start to really need to pay more attention to.
You talked a few moments ago about the importance of reassuring our children in their safety, especially when seeing media and images. So what about a child who has fear at home, who is so worried at night that she's checking doors to make sure that they're locked, making sure that she's safe or he's safe in her home? How can we reassure safety for our children?
Right. When a child is going through repetitive behavior like that and it's becoming something that's really compulsive, I'd really be curious about what else is happening. There may have been a traumatic event. There may have been something that happened that there needs to be further exploration around, because they're trying to feel agency and control of safety by checking the locks 10 times. In order to break the pattern, once we understand what's causing it, in order to break the pattern really is just about getting them to tolerate. So maybe you're taking that down from 10 to 9 to 7 to 6 over time. In order to really allow them to stay calm, in order to feel the sense of agency and control in their family. But I'd be really curious about what's going on in order to cause that kind of problem.
Does the same go for like tics?
Yes. Yeah.
It's normally triggered by something that's happened?
Yeah. And the fact is tics usually go away, but the more that we hyper-focus on them, the more attention we bring to them, and the more that usually the tic actually happens as well. So, but it's, children don't always have the language to communicate what's going on. So it comes out in behaviors.
And same thing for self-harm?
Yes. Yeah. When you can't tolerate, the emotional state becomes so overwhelming that the only way for you to manage it is by harming yourself. And whether that's cutting or whether it's over-exercising, eating disorders, whatever it may be. And that's really important to get a professional involved if there's any suspecting any kind of self-harm is going on with your child.
In terms of, you know, what things that we can do to offer our children support beyond beyond just the communication, do something like a weighted blanket, can that help with anxiety with children?
I am a huge believer in weighted blankets. I have probably 5 in my house. Yes, the one issue to really worry about is coming from a trauma lens, which I'm always going to come from, is if there was any sort of situation where a child had suffocation or felt like there was something that happened where a weighted blanket could actually cause them to feel more unsafe and could cause more anxiety. But what it really does is that they were designed for children on the spectrum with sensory issues in order to calm down their nervous system so they weren't flaring around at night. And it's the same thing with anxiety. If we're moving around the whole night, you know, having some weight on our body is really going to allow us to calm down and our nervous system to calm down.
I just got a weighted blanket over the holidays. Yes. And I've never slept so good in my life.
They're amazing.
I like it. Well, I like one now because I tried it and it has like a cooling thing in it. Before it didn't and I was getting very hot. But now with this one, I'm like, okay, I like this. And my son likes it as well, but only some nights. Mm-hmm. He'll tell me. He's like, I don't want the blanket tonight.
And he can also not have his feet covered sometimes, which is what I find children. So they just have a partial. They also have smaller ones they can just put on their chest, or they have stuffed animals. Aww. So they'll find if kids have a hard time traveling in the car, or maybe it's transition going to school and they have their weighted blanket on them or their weighted stuffed animal as they're going to school, then they find a lot of comfort in that.
Do you think anxiety is a learned or an inherited trait?
That's nature versus nurture, right? We know about epigenetics. We know that in utero, what gets transmitted, trauma gets transmitted to a child. So there is a factor of that, if there's been any stress or trauma, how that gets transmitted to a child's brain. But there's also in the environment, if you are of a parent that struggles with anxiety, there's going to be certain behaviors that you really, that the children are going to learn around you. So it is both. It's not an either or.
Are there certain like supplements, or I know a lot of people talk about oils or something like that to help our children cope with these feelings?
I'm not a doctor to actually prescribe. But there are things that I do really love. And my favorite is holy basil. So it helps with adrenal health. And so especially with anxiety, what we're wanting to do is we want to calm down our adrenals. So they have it in tea. They have it in little droppers that you can put in water. I often recommend it to parents.
What about CBD or EMDR? I hear a lot about those things recently.
Okay. So CBD, I would say no. There's not enough science. We don't really know what's going on around it. We love to market anything that's new. There's plenty of data to support various issues that it has supported, but as a general practitioner, at some point, I wouldn't be recommending that for anxiety at this point, but to each their own, right? EMDR are various modalities to help children or families. There's internal family systems. There's havening technique. There's somatic experiencing, EMDR. These are all great modalities to help with trauma, to help with anxiety. But it really just depends on the individual. So it's not just one thing that actually is going to help everyone. But try them out and work with your practitioner and see what actually works for you. I'm a big believer right now in havening technique. I really love it.
What is it?
Havening technique.
I don't know what that
is. Yeah, I've never heard of it.
It's really
good. I'm like, please shed some light. We have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what it really does is it helps to interrupt that neural network that happens when we do experience trauma or we're experiencing anxiety, because we wire things together, we wire patterns together. And so it interrupts it by actually kind of teaching you really simple things like, you know, doing the alphabet A to Z with animals, or doing cities and countries, counting steps in your mind, doing imagery, because our brains can't be hyper aroused and feel that we're in a threat state and being actually doing higher level thinking at the same time. So it really helps with that. And I've seen so many people really get tremendous amount of results. I've struggled with anxiety, struggled with trauma, and it's something I'm super excited about right now.
Maybe this is going way over my head, but like, what is an example of this, like, mom brain? I'm like, what is, like, hey, is it a practice then that you're?
Yeah. It's a therapy practice that we teach our clients, but it's something that you
How
can
do you
teach.
How spell it?
Havening technique.
Writing it down to Google.
Yes. I'm like, I've got to go to google.com, my professional that I deal with on a daily basis.
Yes. I'm happy to talk to you more about it too.
No, it sounds cool.
Yeah.
And I know this is going to sound a little bit weird, but like, I've also noticed when kids are on electronics a lot, they almost become like zombies. And so therefore you can't even tell their actual behavior, because it's like a detox right after they get off of it. Do you think it's all tied hand in hand? Do you think that there should be a limit? Like, what is the limit?
I love custodial apps that you can be tracking what your kids are doing and how much time they are on. You can set all those limitations for it and what they can see and what they can't. And to your point, yes, their brains do not know the difference between reality and fiction. And when they're getting into Fortnite, they're feeling the same way as if they were actually going to be a drone operator. Right.
That's terrifying.
It's the truth. We actually know that.
I just looked at Leslie like this. Oh, I mean, yeah. My son, he's never played Fortnite, except he went to we were at like somebody's house and he saw him playing. And he has asked me every day, just watching one boy, much older boy, play Fortnite for 15 minutes. He's now asked me for probably over 6 months, can I have Fortnite? Can I have Fortnite? I'm like, what do they put in there that like gets into kids' brain? I'm like, No, you cannot have Fortnite. Stop asking. It's not going to happen. But like, for it to have that big of an impact from just watching somebody else play a game, I don't even get it.
Well, it jacks our nervous system, right? And we're gonna get an adrenaline rush from it. So there's a part of it that's really exciting. The fact is that you're shooting things and you're feeling all exhilarated. But to your point, is getting them off it. It's addictive. There's a social currency around it too that's really, really hard. And these are hard things to navigate. And that's what I love about that website, because I think she really does a great job of explaining from the brain science of what actually is going on with our children that we can't argue with and they can't argue with. It's not kind of Johnny gets to do this or someone else is doing it. It's really kind of understanding, hey, this isn't good for you. And this is why we're not doing it. As a family, this is a decision that we've made, even though it's a hard one to do. But I think it's all talking about moderation and what your child can tolerate and what they can't.
What does moderation look like? Because sometimes if I'm trying to like cook a meal and I have two kids running around the house, like I just need a 30-minute episode of like Paw Patrol to so I can get through.
Take the edge off.
Yeah.
I think that's a great.
For all of us.
Yeah, that's a great time frame too. You're not, it's not 2 hours. It's not, you know, all day. They have unlimited amount of time. You're giving them a finite period of time. There may be even a reward system around it. It may be once you get your homework done, then you get this reward. But giving them a concrete, finite period of time that you're consistent is so important around media for children. And really, again, monitoring it, know what's going on. There's a lot that's happening that so many parents don't know is happening. And then it creeps up on them. And then you have a really big problem.
So it's based on like an hour? Like the amount of time? Like I'm trying to figure out because I feel like just in practicality, like what is a good, what's a good time frame to tell parents?
I mean, parents tend, I tend to sort of say like do 30 minutes of chunks, but it really depends on you. That because sometimes when you get into an hour, then it's the snowball of transitioning out of is so difficult, especially depending on the age of a child. And you really have to look at where their maturity is. A 5-year-old is going to be very different than a 16-year-old.
And how, if you have a bunch of kids and you have one child who's really struggling behaviorally, how do you, we know now we've kind of talked to you about what to do for the child that's struggling, but what about the other kids?
Yeah, that's such a hard thing that I see in my practice a lot too, is just the focus and the hyper focus on the child who's struggling. And then the child who is not, or the children that are not, feel ignored or their needs are not really met. And then later on, it kind of creeps up on the family. So I think it's so important to constantly be checking in with them, to know what's going on, seeing what the impact is. Even having other people, if you don't have the time or capacity because your child's needs, one of your child's needs is so great, that's really where you're kind of bringing in resources of your child's, your children's teachers or their after school activities of their coaches. Hey, can you just check in with them to make sure that they're doing okay? I'm really stressed about this one particular child and I really need the help. So we have to work together as a community and as a tribe and really in order to support our kids.
And you'll a lot of times hear moms, or I'm just saying moms, but I'm sure it's parents, say like, the only way that I can get my kids to listen to me is when I raise my voice. What are your thoughts on that? Like, what are your thoughts on actually snapping at your kids? Or even if it's a planned snap, what are the repercussions of that? I mean, we've come to a time where things have shifted so much from like how I was raised. That, I mean, there was like, I mean, a lot different. But I'm just curious, mm-hmm. because what is the okay way now?
Right. I think it's so important to teach our kids about repair and saying sorry and apologizing and accountability and that we're human. And as a parent, we're going to make mistakes all the time. And to really communicate that to our children is, you know what, I messed up. I should have said something different. I should have acted different. This is the way I wanted to do it. I just got really frustrated. You're going to make mistakes. And I think to be kind to yourself as a parent is so important. The other factor, though, if it becomes sort of a pattern that the only way you feel that you can get your child to do something is by screaming about them, is what you're really teaching them is about dominance and control. And that's not healthy for a child. Is the fact is, in order to be louder and bigger, you have to, in order to get what you want, is not a great way to be parenting. So to really be checking in with that and maybe working with someone in order to support how to communicate with your children differently.
One question that I think is interesting is, when do you push your kids through a new situation or a situation that might feel a little scary for them versus not forcing them into it? I know my daughter with like rides and stuff like at Disneyland, certain things are really scary to her when they shouldn't be. When do you sort of encourage it? And when do you back off?
Yeah, I think it's looking at the situation. If it's something that's going to feel terrifying in their nervous system and it makes sense to you why they would be fearful of doing it, maybe it might not be age appropriate for them at that time. Maybe that ride is she's just too young for at this time. And maybe when she's 10, she'll be super psyched to go on the roller coaster. But I think it's also about setting it up for success. We talk about it ahead of time. We set up the goals. We set up what's going to happen. We love imagery in our brains. And so if they can imagine what's going to happen, it's going to calm them down and then it's going to really make them feel excited and feel so proud when they actually are accomplishing it. And then it's just doing the repetition. Once they've got it down, let's do that again. Let's do that again and keep doing it until it becomes something that they've self-mastered.
Because I know I've fallen to fault to that when it, like, they don't want to try. It's something from, like, the new slide at the park. Like, I don't want to try it. And I'm like, let's try it. Let's try it with mommy first. Boom, we go. There's crying at first. And then, okay, I want to do it again. But then I'm like, did I just push them too far?
No, you didn't. You taught them about that they can actually take risks and they can take care of themselves. I mean, that's a great parenting moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
But at what point then, if my, like, this ride, and I'm sorry to make this about me, but if this, like, ride that she wants to go on and that is, you know, she's tall enough for, her friends are going, all of this, and now it's sort of, at what point does she create, are you creating, like, a monster in their head that, oh, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it, and you sort of just take them down the slide, like Teddy said, and you show them that it isn't this big, bad thing?
Again, I think that's really about kind of doing the imagery with them ahead of time. She's seen the ride. She can even look at it on the internet. She can talk to her friends about their experiences and set that up for success. Figure out where there may be kind of traps where she's just not ready for, or maybe she hasn't kind of worked through her feelings yet about it. But I think if she can imagine what it's going to be like, then that's going to actually encourage her to actually want to take those steps in order to do it. And then when she does it, I mean, it's all hooray, you know, so proud of you. Let's go do that again. And she may be on that ride 3 or 4 times at Disney that day.
What about when it comes to, like, a security blanket or toy or stuffy or whatever it may be? Now, oftentimes in school, they're not letting your kids bring those things in.
Yeah, that's really tough because you've got school policies. But we're talking about children, and their development is all going to be different. And they're going to have different life factors. They're going to have new babies and brothers, or they're going to have a death in the family. And if those things bring them comfort and they soothe them, it's tough. So I think it's really kind of meeting your child where they're at and try to really work with a school. I know I'm a mom, and when we moved to California, my daughter was in 3rd grade and was having a tough time. And we ended up having a hamster in the science lab it really helped her to kind of connect friendships and to talk to people. And I worked with a school in order to make that happen. I mean, it ended up being, like, the highlight of the 3rd grade as well, too. But it's thinking beyond just sort of what the structure of the school looks like and seeing if they can really work with you to accommodate your family.
Did you talk to the actual teacher? Did you talk to the headmaster? Like, what was your approach to actually
make that happen?
Yeah.
I actually did both. I have an introverted child. I gave them Susan Cain's book on quiet and talked to them about just, you know, this is overwhelming for her to be in kind of a new environment, and really advocated for her as a parent to help her and said, hey, you know, how can we sort of set this up for success? And in order to kind of have her connect with people in different ways. And so Snowball became the popular animal to be taking home on the weekends. And it became something that was a tradition, and people knew that that was my daughter's hamster, and it really allowed her just to thrive.
We've talked a bit about sort of younger children. What about teenagers that are kind of suffering from anxiety, like a 15-year-old who's not sleeping, or a 15-year-old who's, like, moved to a new location and they're now having this? Like, what are ways that we can help our teenagers?
Especially when they're like, I don't like the therapist you took me to, and it happens repeatedly.
Right. So, unfortunately, 1/3 of our teenagers ages 13 to 18 are going to experience anxiety. We know that college freshmen, the statistics are 41%. We're seeing rates going through the roof for our youth at this point. I mean, anxiety is a real problem for them. And it's hard because they're around it so much, and there's so much conversation around it that actually even causes more anxiety. Again, I think it's really about educating them. I work with a ton of teenagers, and they feel so empowered to really understand how their bodies and brains are working and learning coping skills in order to kind of manage that. So whether it's pinky breathing in order for them to learn abdomen breaths, whether it's using imagery, whether it's doing various techniques, tooling them up in order for them to keep grabbing at things in order to calm them down. The other really interesting thing that I brought up earlier, too, is about labeling emotions. I've had so many kids come in and they're telling me that they have a panic attack before they're going to their first dance or their prom or their first kiss. And they've labeled that as something that's scary and terrifying versus something that's so exciting. And so we really have to kind of shift them to understand that they have the capacity to have more feelings than just 4. and that it's okay for them to feel exciting, to have heart palpitations and to be nervous about a first kiss. That's a good thing. And we've got to kind of start wiring our brains in that way.
How do you know as a parent, though, if your child is just having that nervous, excited energy? Like, I know if I'm about to go, like, speak to a group of people or that I'm not having anxiety. I'm excited, and that's a good thing, and it means that I'm going to deliver well. That being said, for a kid or, you know, a teenager who could possibly be having, like, a true-blown panic attack, mm-hmm. how do you know if that's happening versus the other?
I'm not saying that they are not having a panic attack about going to the prom. I'm saying that they have actually not allowed themselves to even imagine the fact that they could feel excited. They've just kind of limited their feeling states to just these few things. That's one of the really big issues. But the other issue, to your point, is just the amount of pressure. We've got to take the pressure off for these kids. They feel like they have to have everything figured out. They have to be masters. They have to know where they're going to college. They have to be experts in their sports, single sports. They're having burnout. They're having injuries. And we have to kind of say, it's okay if you're not getting the A. It's okay if you're not being the top athlete. It's okay if you're not, you know, succeeding at everything. They just feel this tremendous amount of pressure. So we really need to be able to hold the emotions that they're not able to carry. That's our job as parents, and in order to help them launch.
And in closing, because I know we're running out of time, what would you say the key piece of advice you could give to any parent out there on anything regarding this topic, like the one takeaway?
The one takeaway is just really about being curious about your children, understanding and connecting with them and being present with them to really allow them to feel like they have a safe space that they can really talk about their feelings. They can talk about things that are hard. And then really trying to teach them how to resource and come up with solutions to combat these issues, that they're not carrying around these nervous states in their bodies all the time.
That's a good takeaway.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's a good thing for us to think about too. I mean, how often do we think we're present, but we're not necessarily 100% present as parenting?
All the time. I'm like,
because it happens, you know, sometimes like I'm like, okay, I'm putting the phone completely down. It's our time. We're doing this. And then my mind will wander and I'm not actually fully, my body's there and I'm not looking at the phone, but I need to, you know, continue. And I write that down like as like in my goals or like my daily goals is like, be present. And this, I have the same thing with adults, with everything. And so I think that's such a huge thing for all of us to think about is like really figure out a way that works for you, that you can be present when you're doing things. If not, we're just going through the motions and like not really living the life that we want to live.
And I think to your point, like being present in ways that like you feel like you can be present for. Like, I don't know if that's like if you're you can sit down and play Old Maid with your kids or Legos or whatever, or something that like you can actually engage with as well. So it's sort of fun.
So
everyone.
It's knowing, like, I'm not a craft gal. Like, I'm not the one that like wins the, like our kids never win craft day. Cause I'm not the mom that's like gonna be killing it at that. But like, I love to like take my family on like family hikes or we play soccer or we're doing, you know, bike rides, those types of things where we can laugh, talk about our favorite songs. Like that for me is my like best way to spend time with the kids. But I know some moms who can get down on the ground and like they can honestly play Barbies for 2 hours. That's not my strong suit. So it's kind of knowing your strong suit and formulating around it.
Right.
I mean, at least that's what I'm telling myself.
I think you're making a great point too, because it may be that your family is a ping pong family, or you may be swimmers, or you may be having Friday night game nights. And also too, using humor is so important for kids. So just laughing, you mentioned that. It's just so important. So have fun, be present, do things together.
Try not to take ourselves too seriously.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, you guys, thank you so much for coming on today. I truly appreciate it. And I think we got through a lot of the questions. I think we hammered through. So I hope you guys keep sending in your questions, no matter what the topic is. We will get to it. I love this. So thank you guys for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe to Teddy Teapot on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to podcasts.